Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Enquirer restaurant critic Craig LeBand joins us. We'll talk about the hottest dining trends and why he's dropping the Liberty Bell ratings for good. Also, our favorite superstitions around big events like the World Series. But first, you might have seen warnings of the potential for a twindemic or tridemic this fall, words used to describe the expected emergence of two or even three significant viruses simultaneously. Doctors in some parts of the country have been seeing a rapid increase in flu and RSV cases, along with the continuing presence of COVID, leading to concerns that local health systems might face an overwhelming number of patients. Still, not all experts are convinced that a health emergency is inevitable, especially if simple preventive measures are followed by the public. Dr. Emmanuel Goldman is professor of microbiology at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School, and he joins us now to walk us through the cold weather viral season. Emmanuel Goldman, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Welcome to you too.
Oh, thank you. So how concerned should we be about big viruses emerging at the same time with the fall season upon us? And Emmanuel, is tridemic even a word?
It's a new word. I don't know that you'll find it in the dictionary yet. There is a reasonable concern about the flu and COVID, certainly. The third virus that's been in the mix, RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, is a virus that affects children predominantly. Vaccination is still the first line of defense, and I urge all of your listeners to get a flu vaccination, as well as the COVID vaccination, especially the new booster, the bivalent booster.
Yeah. Let's talk about some other preventive measures before we get back to vaccination. 2.5 years ago, Emmanuel, when COVID-19 first hit, we were sanitizing everything, mail, groceries, kitchen counter surfaces. What do you think of this response to the pandemic, which was emerging at the time, with the benefit of hindsight, and also looking ahead as some of these viruses converge?
Right. Well, I think that was a mistake by the scientific establishment and the public health officials. It was a well-meaning mistake. The intent was to protect the public.
Sure.
But the transmission of respiratory viruses on surfaces, the technical term we use for that is fomites, that is based upon experiments that are not related to the real world. And I called the attention of the scientific community to that in an article in The Lancet in July of 2020, which I titled Exaggerated Risk of Transmission of COVID-19 from Fomites. The reason why it was believed that you could get the virus from surfaces was based on experiments called virus survival experiments. You put the virus on a surface and you follow over time and see how much virus is left. But this was in a laboratory setting, and the amount of virus that was used in these kinds of experiments, particularly I'm talking about SARS-CoV-2, the cause mm-hmm. of COVID-19, the amount of virus that was used was way, way, way too much. I mean, humongous amounts of virus. Viruses decay, most of them decay in the environment. They die. And they die with a predictable half-life, so that if you wait a certain time interval, half the virus is dead and half remains, and then you repeat that time interval and half of what was left has died and half of what was left remains, or a quarter.
Interesting.
And so on. And you continue that on out until there's no more virus left. So obviously, if you start out with much, much higher amount of virus, it'll take a lot longer till you get to the end point of less than one virus left on the surface. And in real life, you don't encounter those kinds of virus quantities.
So at over sanitizing was not the way to excessive sanitizing was not the way to help prevent transmission of COVID, which of course in early 2020 was especially deadly because we did not have vaccines and in many cases we're not sure, you know, exactly how to treat it. Since then, I understand you've authored a paper manual in which you argue that most viruses and bacteria are transmitted primarily through the air. So I guess, are we talking about COVID and the flu here? And if so, what does this mean when it comes to prevention? You talked about vaccines. Is masking still really important?
Yeah, first, I just want to correct you. It's most respiratory viruses.
Okay.
And bacteria were not part of this paper.
Okay.
Masking is still a valid strategy, a good strategy. We need to find ways to treat the air, the indoor air. And people have tried things like enhanced ventilation, HEPA filtration, ultraviolet light treatment of the air at the point of the filtration. You can't do that while people are present, but you could do it at some remote location. There's also a new material that I'm very anxious to see approved by public health officials and regulators that kills the virus in the air, and it's perfectly safe to breathe. And these are products based on a chemical called triethylene glycol.
Mm-hmm.
And this chemical has been around for decades and decades. It was first published on in the 1940s. It's considered generally recognized as safe for humans to breathe. It's been used in the theater for special effects for decades with no harm to people. It's used in air freshener sprays like Oust and Glade of sprays like that. And it's been found to kill virus in the air. And so I'm very anxious for this to be approved because I think this would be a great addition to our arsenal in controlling this pandemic and future pandemics.
Any idea as to when the regulatory process might take a real hard look at this and eventually approve it?
I wish I could have the answer to that. I can tell you that it is approved in 7 states, and I think Pennsylvania is one of those states.
Okay.
Where you can get products with triethylene glycol to use for purifying the air.
So in the meantime, vaccines, masking where appropriate, which I'm assuming at this point is if you are perhaps at the grocery store where there are a lot of people, many workplaces still mandate it. Outside, you still okay outside, Emmanuel, do you think, without a mask?
No,
unless you're in a big crowd?
It's not necessary unless you're in a very close crowd, like at a rock concert or something.
Got it. So where does good old-fashioned hand-washing fit in, and should we still be singing, the happy birthday song, which, I think bought us 20 seconds while we were washing.
Hand washing is still recommended, and I recommend it, but not because of COVID or the flu. I recommend it because it's a way to prevent many other kinds of infections that you could get from surfaces from your hands, and bacterial infections fit into this. There's some gastrointestinal viruses like norovirus that you can get that way. Our mothers taught us, if you want to prepare food, you wash your hands. If you go to the bathroom, you wash your hands. If you touch something dirty, you wash your hands. This is common sense, proper hygiene. We shouldn't need a pandemic to tell us this.
Speaking of parents, many of whom, if you've got a young child and a baby probably are concerned about RSV, which I understand is able to remain infectious on various environmental surfaces like the kitchen countertop. Do you recommend that parents with young children be a little bit more intent when it comes to sanitizing around the house?
If they're in a house with just their parents, and the house is clean, I don't think you have to go crazy over it. But if you go to something like a daycare center, you may want to be sure that hands are washed and the surfaces are wiped down. But you really only have to wipe it down with soap and water or alcohol-based. You don't need these harsh chemical disinfectants, which can cause more harm than good.
Okay. And, of course, today is Halloween. Two years ago, Emmanuel, on Halloween, many of us put together elaborate setups for trick-or-treaters who did venture out, taking care that, you know, we were far apart as the kids received their treats. You know, things have changed somewhat regarding COVID in 2022, even as it's obviously still with us. Any thoughts as kids make the rounds later today about preventing illness?
I'm not too worried about trick-or-treaters. It is outdoors for the most part. There's no evidence of transmission of these viruses on food or on packaging. I'm talking about flu and COVID, mm-hmm. in particular. I'm not too worried about the trick or treaters.
All right, that's encouraging. So how challenging is it to produce vaccines which keep up with the variants that are emerging in COVID or flu, Emmanuel?
Well, flu is a perennial problem because it has a high ability to change from season to season. I have heard that the vaccine that's available for flu this season actually is a pretty good match for the virus strains that are circulating. COVID also has the ability to mutate, not as rapidly as flu, and so we have seen variants in COVID. More than I would have expected, actually, at the beginning from my knowledge of coronavirus biology. I'm very encouraged by the new bivalent vaccine that's been just released and that people are getting, which now has some protection against Omicron. I'm hopeful the science will stay one step ahead or maybe only one step behind.
as we all are. Emmanuel Goldman, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We appreciate you being with us here on the Regional Roundup. Emmanuel Goldman is professor of microbiology at the Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. Up next on the Roundup, we are joined by Philadelphia Inquirer restaurant critic Greg LeBan, who says we should no longer hold eateries to pre-pandemic scorecards, and he'll tell us why he's doing away with his famous bell rating system. Stay with us for more.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Craig LeBan is famous for his restaurant reviews, in which he assigned a series of Liberty Bells to rate eating establishments, from zero bells to the superlative four. LeBan is restaurant critic and columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He shelved the bells as the pandemic began to decimate the restaurant industry, an industry still facing numerous challenges. And he recently made the decision against putting the bells back into play, even as other publications like the Boston Globe and New York Times revived their rating systems. We're going to ask him about that decision now and talk about progress dining establishments have made toward getting back to the old pre-pandemic normal. Craig LeBan, a pleasure to have you with us on the Regional Roundup. Hello.
Good morning, Mary. It's so great to be here.
Oh, thank you. Let's talk first about how the restaurant industry is faring 2.5 years since COVID sprung itself on the world. You wrote earlier this month, the Philadelphia restaurant revival is hot and ready for dinner. So amazing food is being prepared. But Craig, you also write separately, virtually nothing is the same behind the scenes. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's really the case. I mean, you know, we've seen a lot of activity, new restaurants popping online, old restaurants, of course. We've lost many during the pandemic. And we've seen replacements, and we've seen a lot of activity, and we see people going out to eat. But people no longer have the capital that they once had before the pandemic. They lost a tremendous amount of money during this last 2.5 years. Staffing, in particular, is very, very difficult. And so restaurants can't achieve, most restaurants cannot achieve sort of the level of operations that they once had. And that could be a matter of paring down menus. That could be a matter of paring down hours. You know, Tuesday's the new Monday around here. Restaurants are often closed. Restaurants close sooner. So basically, those are the sort of economic solutions behind the scenes that restaurants have sort of taken to sort of handle what's given to them. Of course, there's also, you know, tremendous inflation of ingredients that affects prices on menus.
Sure.
So, you know, if you go out in Center City or anywhere else in Philadelphia on a particular, you know, Thursday or Friday night, you're going to see restaurants are busy. I see restaurants are busy, the ones that are being talked about. And the Center City District last year said that we're back to about 74% of spending on restaurants in Center City that we were in 2019. And this is older data, and I suspect we're even farther along because people are out in restaurants again. But what goes on behind the scenes is not quite there.
Yeah, noteworthy, even as you also say, the mental stress has taken a lasting toll on hospitality in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, you just think about, you know, your average, you know, server job or host job, you know, in 2019 suddenly became in 2020, you know, hall monitor / behavior cop, making sure people were masking and wrangling people and telling people all these rules that were for the greater good, and people just didn't want to deal with that. And a lot of times it got very contentious for people. Coming to work became this equation of preserving self-health. And that people didn't think about that before.
Yeah, so that's so tough. Craig Levan, you also write, the landscape is different, less formal. Could you get into that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a continuation of a trend that I think has been going on for a long time. You know, the sort of old school fine dining model with white tablecloths and, you know, with French haute cuisine sort of being sort of the core sort of principle that sort of defined what was excellent. That has been evolving for a long time before we got to the pandemic. And it sort of hit another expression of enthusiasm, I think, you know, as people got out back to eating out. The restaurants that seem to have the most energy to me right now are sometimes not the ones where you're going to spend 3 hours at a table, you know, being doted on, but just of this more lively sort of no tablecloths, a little bit more casual, easier access to just enjoying your time. And we have put out a dining guide not long ago for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I talk about this. A number of the restaurants that made my top 10 list have sibling restaurants that are a little bit fancier. You know, I'm talking about, like, for example, like Laser Wolf or Fiorella. These are second restaurants of restaurant groups that have much more sort of upscale places. But there's a tremendous energy and vibrance that's going on in the relaxed environments of those places that capture, I think, the moment right now.
That's encouraging. We've got a question from Sigrid who says, or asks rather, we returned to a restaurant recently that we hadn't been to since before the pandemic, and it had QR code menus and ordering. We found it very frustrating and didn't enjoy staring at our phones for the first 15 minutes. Is this the way things are headed?
You know, there were a lot of technical, solutions that popped up during the pandemic to sort of curtail the spread of COVID, and QR codes was one of those things. And I think the QR codes are here to stay. I personally love to hold a paper menu, you know, and see it all laid out. But they also seem a little wasteful to me now. You know, we talk about sustainability and the use of paper and the, sort of the constantly throwing these things away. And do you really want to touch something that somebody else touched, you know, 5 minutes before you that wasn't sanitized? I mean, so the practical reasons that it existed, I think, are obvious, but the sort of lingering nature of QR codes is rooted in, I think, just our overall push as society to a digital world.
Okay, fair enough. So, Craig LeBan, your Liberty Bells were a real Philly-centric hallmark of the area dining scene. How'd they first come about?
Well, so I came to the Philadelphia Inquirer in 1998. I had worked previously at the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, where they had a rating system of their own. They used to give out red beans. But they actually, the Times-Picayune, yes, is no longer what it once was, so we can say past tense. But when I came to the Inquirer at that time, my predecessor, Elaine Tate, had been doing this job for 35 years, which is, I'm still in awe of that longevity. And she was, you know, one of the few critics at the time that didn't rate restaurants, and that, you know, there's always been a discussion as to whether ratings were good or bad for a lot of reasons that we can get into. But at that time, you know, rating restaurants was very standard procedure for major newspapers and publications. It was just a sort of a way to make sense of dining scenes that were growing very fast, to help give readers an easy tool to sort of make those decisions. So I had come up with a rating system. I had learned to do my job using a rating system. It made a lot of sense to me. And I decided to give Philadelphia its own, and we created the Liberty Bell system. We went from four bells being the very best and being a very exclusive category down to the Nobel Prize you didn't want to win.
Gee. You know, and that said, you know, the restaurant industry, of course, has been through the ringer in the past couple of years. So ratings, good or bad?
Well, you know, we paused the ratings in 2020, right in the middle of March, when the restaurant shut down. It absolutely made no sense to give out ratings to restaurants that were struggling simply to survive. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, the discussion of ratings versus no ratings is sort of timeless as restaurant criticism itself. And even before the pandemic, there had been sort of a pushback against ratings, and several publications had already decided they were against them. And this is something that still worked for us leading up to the pandemic, because it was my system. I was able to sort of craft it the way I thought was fair and useful. But when you get to the pandemic, you know, it just, you know, I was like, well, let's pause this, obviously, while restaurants are just trying to survive.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you flash back to March 2020, nobody could imagine how long and how deeply impacted our society would be by COVID. Most of us, at least, thought that, you know, in a few months we'll get through this wave of a virus and we'll get back to it and let's move forward. So, but it never really happened. You know, I don't need to repeat history. We all lived through it together.
Sure.
You know, one wave after the other. And just when you think that things were heading towards normal, slowly but surely, you know, finally they let us do eat outside. And then, you know, 6 months later, it was like you could go inside. It was only 25% occupied dining room. And I personally didn't eat inside until I was vaccinated in March of 2021.
Hmm.
So I went a whole year or more without eating inside of a dining room.
So that's a challenge for a restaurant critic.
Well, it was not. I won't say it's anything I'd ever want to repeat. But as a journalist, it certainly forced me to sort of rethink how we do our job. And you know what, restaurants were ever as essential as ever, and as feeding us, but also as a focal point for what was going on in our society, the sort of struggle to get back to normal. Restaurants were the bellwether of our interactions with people, with each other in public spaces.
So, Craig, why drop the Liberty Bells permanently?
Well, I kept waiting for things to get back to normal, and the, you know, air quotes around that, and it never really happened to the extent where we are back in restaurants now. eating out, and it feels normal, but obviously, as I noted before, I mean, staffs aren't the same, expectations aren't the same, the abilities aren't the same, the variables are so constantly changing for restaurants that something you say about a restaurant in, you know, in January might be completely different by June or July through no fault of their own, you know, greater forces in the world. So when you ratings have this longevity to them that sometimes or that often outlives the context of a written review.
Okay.
And basically, you know, my contention was really before the pandemic, the expiration date on a rating might have been 2 or 3 years if you're lucky, which is pretty good. But you know, good enough that if you're keeping tabs on a restaurant scene, the important players, you know, you can cultivate that and reshape it slowly but surely. Now the expiration date is just too soon. And what happens is those ratings don't mean much anymore. They're not useful. And my goal was always to be, you know, helpful. I'm a consumer reporter as much as anything. I'm trying to give people advice on where to eat. And if I've given them a rating on a restaurant that 6 months down the road no longer applies, I'll regret giving that rating a high rating if things go south for all kinds of reasons that
sure.
We didn't used to talk about. So, you know, you just think about if ratings were meant to be a tool to help your readers, are they really helping readers anymore if they don't last longer than a month? And I came to the conclusion that no, that wasn't the case.
Okay. Craig, when you dine out, describe the process as you work and the elements you take into consideration as you are considering a restaurant's capabilities.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, I try very much to sort of take in the forefront facing, the customer facing experience of restaurants. You know, I never make reservations at restaurants in my own name. The Inquirer always pays for everything I eat. We do not have relationships with the people we cover, other than just professional ones, right? And so I will go to restaurants unannounced and order as much as I can. try the various things. And sometimes it's a wonderful job. I'll never complain. And often over multiple meals, so you can sort of capture a sense of consistency, and sometimes you see restaurants in sort of different lights. You know, weekdays versus weekends are often very different. So, that process hasn't really changed a whole lot for me. And once I come and go and do those meals, I have long phone interviews with owners and chefs where we talk about the food that was cooked for me, but often, you know, the stories on how people got there and what they're about and what they were hoping for with the restaurant. You know, what are the goals? What are their missions here? And, you know, that just all feeds into just this big body of information that I sit down and draw on and really try to capture the story of that restaurant in that moment.
Let's talk about anonymity. I mean, years ago when you spoke with Marty Moscoin on Radio Times, I hear you came into the studio with a box on your head. After all these years, I mean, how have you been able to maintain your anonymity, even as you go into a restaurant and you perform the process you just described, and then you talk with movers and shakers at the restaurant, and you know, and how do you do it?
Well, I think we should define our terms. Anonymity sometimes has been overused. It can mean usually that you don't even use your own name. I'm a real person. Let's put it. I use my real name, so I'm not a made up fictional diner that has had multiple authors over the years. But in terms of anonymity, that's trying to remain sort of physically unknown is I think a restaurant critic ideal also that dates to, you know, before I got started and has been very difficult to maintain over the years.
Yes, yeah.
It's been next to impossible. I think I've been pretty open about this in terms of, you know, it's a very small big city, Philadelphia, and I've had many servers multiple times. In fact, I've had children of servers serve me over the years. I've been here long enough, and restaurateurs multiple generations. But the point is, do my best to come unannounced, so you know they have to perform on the spot. And once I'm in a restaurant, you know, I'm still not there to be friends and old pals with people. I'm really there to eat and experience the restaurant. I would certainly never be rude to somebody if they came up to me and wanted to have a conversation. And I have so much respect for the people I cover. But again, we don't have a friend relationship. I'm there to sort of talk about what they're doing in the restaurant and where it fits into our dining scene right now.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, Craig LeBand, no more Liberty Bells. Let's talk about briefly about your top 10 list. We've got about a minute left.
Yeah.
What goes into deciding for your list an eating establishment will make the list? And also, this list is not ranked, right?
Exactly. The not ranking is consistent, I think, with this philosophy of not really rating restaurants anymore. They do capture what I feel is the sort of the essence and spark of the moment that's going on in the dining scene right now, but they each occupy a unique space. And so it's not a horse race. These places are not competing against each other. They really just represent something special. And we have a great range of places. Her Place Supper Club, started as a pop-up, and it has evolved into this very special restaurant that changes menus every 2 weeks. Friday, Saturday, Sunday is a local institution that is at its best right now. They have really focused on tasting menus, which is another trend coming out of the pandemic, where you can really do a lot and focus on something. You can do a lot with less staff and focus on a singular mission. We have restaurants that are, Cantina La Martina is up in Kensington, and they're doing something very magical in a neighborhood where there haven't been a lot of special restaurants lately. So we try to, get all around the region, including Sweet Amalia, Oyster Cafe and Market in the middle of New Jersey, which is sort of where you see wonderful New Jersey seafood sort of coming together on picnic tables with wonderful sandwiches and preparations made with Jersey produce.
Wow. My mouth is watering, Craig.
Yeah. Well, we have
can't wait for lunch. It's 10:39.
We are so lucky to have such diversity in this region to eat. So many things. Laser Wolf is a good example of one of these second restaurants. It's kind of the big brother restaurant is Zaha, which is one of our most famous restaurants and still wonderful.
Well, listen, there's the music. So unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. But we'll close on this. You write, from my vantage, Philly's dinner scene looks as vibrant and exciting as ever. So some positive news. Craig LeBand, thank you so much for joining us.
Mary,
so much
fun. It's been fun. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Stay tuned. The regional roundup continues.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. Game 3 of the World Series at Citizens Bank Park tonight, and fans everywhere are biting their nails and perhaps doubling down on the rituals, which might not make much sense, but feel like they will somehow impact the game. Perhaps, wearing one special shirt throughout the series, or sitting in the exact same seat for every game, eating specific snacks on game day, that sort of thing. Also, a tiny Billy Penn statue sits atop the highest beam of the Comcast Technology Center, hopefully averting the so-called curse of Billy Penn. We're going to take a look now at some of our favorite rituals and superstitions and why we do what we do when the stakes are high. If you'd like to share, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. J.P. Romney is writer and director of audio at the Philadelphia Citizen. He joins us now on the Roundup. Hi, J.P.
Hi, how you doing? Nice to speak with you.
I'm well. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I was reading your article in the Philadelphia Citizen, and I was laughing out loud at some of the rituals that you were characterizing, including the fan who won't watch a game live because, in your words, they believe the direction of their eyes will somehow jinx the team through cathodes, coils, glass, and despite a 7-second broadcast delay. many of us can relate, JP.
Sure.
For the most part, those of us who do indulge are rational people the other 21 hours of the day.
Of course.
Why do we gravitate towards superstition, especially with something like the World Series?
What I found was that I think it's a way for us to feel powerful in a situation which we really, truthfully, are powerless to influence the outcome of something. I mean, you know, it's a question of the players and the coaches and sometimes just luck. And what the viewers actually do isn't going to make any kind of an effect, but it makes us feel that way. And I think that's one of the reasons it has such longevity and it has such power, these superstitions.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the superstitions most of fandom has bought into in Philly. One of the most widely known is the curse of Billy Penn, you know, stemming from a gentleman's agreement that no building would be constructed higher than the hat of the statue of William Penn atop Philadelphia City Hall. As you write, JP, in life, William Penn was revered for democracy, religious freedom, and the pursuit of peace. In death, he's known to be a tad petty about his placement.
Yes, that is true. And I think that, you know, when I was first doing this article, I was trying to figure out where exactly this gentleman's agreement came from in the first place. And it's rather ambiguous where it even came from. I mean, I was reading articles, you know, law review journals that were trying to figure this out, and no one really knows where this came from. But I think the gist of it was that Billy Penn stood for these specific ideals, and we as a city just kind of agreed sometime around the Second World War that those ideals should both metaphorically and literally stand above anything else in the city, that, you know, religious freedom and democracy and peace, and that it kind of became this ceiling for the city.
The top of his hat.
The very top of his hat, which is interesting because some things I was reading was saying that that he was depicted that way because he wouldn't doff his hat to the English king.
Interesting.
And, you know, so it's this idea that the ideals of the city should top everything else, that that's kind of the heart and soul of the city, and nothing should go higher than it.
So One Liberty Place went up in 1987. What happened then to Philadelphia sports?
Well, you know, it seems like there was a downturn during the next 30 years. There was just a downturn. Our sports teams were doing fairly well up to that point, and then there was just a slump. And it happened to coincide with that. And that's kind of where the superstition was born, that breaking those ideals, right, that Billy Penn stood for. Because really, it's not like the ghost of Billy Penn is looking down and being like, you know, I am actually that petty about my placement. Now I'm going to curse players. But that it's more that the ideals that Billy Penn stood for were superseded by something else in our lives, capitalism, whatever the case may be. And that those are the origins of the curse, which somehow then manifested to making Philly players play just a little bit poorly.
Somehow.
From that point forward. Yeah, for the next 30 years.
Yeah. Well, what did Comcast do in 2007? Tell us that story.
Well, that is interesting because David Cohen, who was the executive vice president of Comcast at the time, they made a video where this was in 2007, and he was saying, you know, I'm a big supporter of Philly sports teams, and I'm a big supporter of what Billy Penn stood for. So when the Comcast Center goes up, which topped One Liberty Place, we are going to restore Billy Penn to his rightful place above the city. And, you know, if you've ever seen the Billy Penn statue really up close, you'll realize what an absolute behemoth that thing is on the top of City Hall. We're talking like 26 tons and 37 feet high. And on top of the Comcast Center, they put like a 2-foot statue.
Which was stolen, wasn't it?
Which was then stolen.
Only in Philadelphia.
Yeah. I don't know who stole it, but somebody stole it, and then it was replaced by an even smaller statue, which is like 4.5 inches high. It really looks like kind of a large Monopoly piece, and that was stuck on the railing on the top of the Comcast Center. So that was dominant until Comcast topped itself with the Technology Center in 2017, and iron workers there, you know, had enough sense, I guess, to follow the tradition and place another Monopoly-sized piece of Billy Penn somewhere up in the antenna or something.
Well, then, of course, the Eagles won the Super Bowl in February of 2018. And then let's roll back to, you know, the maneuvering Comcast did in 2007 with the statues of Billy Penn, but then the Phillies won the World Series in 2008. So really, any doubters were probably even more swayed by this quote-unquote curse of Billy Penn.
There are people that didn't believe in the curse of Billy Penn. But then, you know, when they put that little statuette up, it basically glued it to the top of the Comcast Center. It just so happens in this video, this that was taken in 2007, it was before the Phillies win in 08. And he's like, I don't know, I guess we'll see what happens. And then, you know, crazy circumstances, they actually did win 2008. And so you had to have a bunch of people that flipped around and said, okay, we're believers now. Let's not look at what happened in 2009.
I was just going to say, Yankees beat the Phils in the World Series in 2009. Yeah. Did this change anybody back? believers into disbelievers? I don't know. None of this is supposed to make sense, right?
It isn't. It's more about the ideals and the power of superstitions and the things that go on behind the superstitions rather than the actual meat and potatoes of the superstitions themselves, because they are kind of contradictory.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm not even sure. In fact, I'd take a pretty good guess to say that even in 2007 and then in 2017 with the Technology Center, Billy Penn's hat, it wasn't like on City Hall where his hat was the highest point. You know, I mean, there are parts of a building now that they didn't have to take into consideration in 1894 before we had helicopters and airplanes and all of that. So I'm sure that his hat was never the highest point since 1987.
But, interesting. You know,
just don't look too closely.
Okay. Well, listen, before we go on to the Pico story, one quick note. Mayor Kenney is not giving any reason for apparently his decision to not allow the wearing of apparel on the actual statue of Billy Penn. No Phillies jersey, hat, or anything. So anywho, we'll see what happens tonight. Anyway, back to the Pico story. Yes, right. The Crown Lights have been a Philly landmark for nearly 50 years at the, atop the iconic building at 23rd and Market. But at one point, JP, there were rules at Pico about what could not go atop this building when a championship title is at stake. Pico having apparently learned the hard way.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it seems like 2005 was deeply, deeply scarring for the city. That was, of course, our Super Bowl loss to the Patriots.
Yes.
And that pops up in Pico's decision. They did a press release that basically said they'd compiled scientific evidence that whether or not they turn the crown lights on or off does have an effect on the outcome of the game. So in 2005, the Pico crown lights were on, and they were doing specific messaging using the word Eagles and using the logos. Of course, 05 is a loss. In 09, they did the same thing, and the Phils lost the World Series. The lights were apparently off in 08 for whatever reason, and the Phils win the World Series. And then in 2016, the Villanova Wildcats win the NCAA National Championship. So they had compiled this scientific evidence and said, well, you know, if we keep the lights on, it's a jinx. If we do this specific team messaging, so they did a press release in January of 18 and said, we're not going to do any team messaging. And in place of the word Eagles, they ran go underdogs in green with the picture of a German Shepherd and then an eagle flying. So they implied it. They just didn't actually say it. And of course, you know, we know what happened in 18,
sure,
2 weeks later.
So, JP Romney, as a fan, do you subscribe to any game day rituals? Anything that you would cop to?
Oh, that I would cop to. You know, I have to admit, I'm a bit jaded. I think I'm a little bit jaded, which is probably why they chose me to write that specific article. I don't know that I have any specific game day superstitions or really even any superstitions. Ever since I was a kid, I tend not to step on cracks. I don't think it really has any effect on my mother's bone structure, it's something that I passed to my kids and, you know, when we're walking along. And it's just something that binds us. And I think that's the point of these superstitions anyway. This is something that binds us all together as a city or, whatever. And in these divisive times, anything that promotes unity, anything that we can all look together and join together on, I think, is a good thing, no matter what.
Yeah, so some superstition around sports and et cetera can be a good thing. All right. So any word, JP, around planning, any planning the city of Philadelphia might be undertaking regarding a parade?
Well,
or parades, because the Union are now, they're competing for the MLS Cup on Saturday.
Absolutely. Well, you know, like I had mentioned before, 2005 was just so scarring. And most of the citywide superstitions have some sort of a root in that 2005 loss, whether it's the Pico Lights or the Billy Penn statue, which hadn't gone up yet because that was in 07. But weirdly enough, Bill Belichick got his hands on the planned parade route in 2005 and pulled it up in front of the players, the Patriots, in his pregame speech. And it was almost like, look at these arrogant Philadelphians. look at this city. They're so arrogant. They have this parade route planned. And then he listed the exact stops. They're going to stop here. They're going to stop there. They're going to end at the Art Center. And it was just a point of like arrogance. And it was something to fire the team up. We're going to show them. We're going to show the city. And in reality, like all cities do this.
Sure.
If the Office of Special Events didn't plan something, it would just be absolute pandemonium. It would be a riot. Of course we have that. But there was a superstition that kind of popped up in 05 that reading those specific stops out somehow jinxed the team. So again, 05 was a tough year for us. Tough year. But when I did contact the Office of the Mayor, they said they kind of dodged the issue. They didn't. I asked specifically, do you believe in the superstition? They dodged that and they just said, well, you know, the planning for this begins when it begins.
We got a comment from Dee who says, my husband has not been wearing any Phillies gear for the last month. Now that we're in the series, he's choosing to still not wear any Phil's hat a T-shirt. I get that. I get that. You know, sometimes I feel, and it makes no sense, that if I'm watching the game, I cannot move from my seat when they're doing well because somehow this is going to affect the play, which I know makes no sense, but it's a strong feeling. Listen, we only have a couple more minutes, but I did want to get into some eerie connections, shaky as they might be, between historic Phillies wins and economic downturns.
Right. So this is probably, for me, this is the one with the most evidence behind it, because the Phillies have won two World Series, and that was in 1980 and 2008. And both of those years were economic downturns. Great Recession, there's economic downturn in 80. Yeah. And then the Athletics won in 1929, which was probably the darkest economic year in American history. And then we have, you know, this year, and the economy's being a little shaky with the inflation and all of that. And so people have started to see a connection between the Phils in particular doing well in the World Series and these different economic downturns. So, I mean, that has pretty good evidence for it, but I'm just hoping that, you know, fingers crossed with the Phils in the World Series coming up here, you know, that with Game 3 happening tonight, that this isn't going to somehow continue on to an even worse economic downturn. Let's hope that this is one superstition that breaks.
We're with you on that one, JP. Quick question for you. Is Philly different than any other town when it comes to this sort of thing, superstitions?
Oh. You know, I asked friends and family circles when I was writing this article. I was like, "Well, what do you picture when you think of Phillies fans?" And listen, very devoted, very fanatic, very committed to their teams, but maybe not the best of sportsmanship is at least the idea that's out there. And I think that there is something maybe important about having these superstitions, because maybe they act as a diversion. Maybe they act as kind of a straw man, where that negative energy could be aimed at players or coaches or other fans or, you know, people who do or don't wear, you know, particular gear or do or don't watch the game or do or don't react to it. That instead of aiming all of our anger, you know, at other people, kind of nice to have a straw man to aim it at.
Yeah, I agree. Well, listen, we're going to go out on Stevie Wonder's Superstition from the 1972 album Talking Book. Why not? JP, thanks for joining us. As you said in the close of your Philadelphia Citizen piece, Go Phillies, Birds, Union 2, and Sixers and Flyers, and whatever our lacrosse team is called. I think it's the Wings.
There you go, the Wings. Go Wings.
Yeah, go Wings. J.P. Romney writes for the Philadelphia Citizen. Thanks.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Don't forget, you can find the regional roundup at WHYY.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez is our engineer. Our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us. Be well. Sugar's just everywhere.